Hello, and welcome back to the Building Our Future podcast with me, Bert Broadhead. Today, we're reverting back to the retail sector. Now, all sectors are undergoing massive changes brought about by the digital economy, and possibly none more so than retail. While new operating models are to a penny in the office and residential worlds, there seems to be a remarkably muted innovation response from the built environment to changes in the retail sector. How better to understand how to respond to the challenges and to really understand what the problems are? So for this, I've tracked down retail CEO turned author, Mark Pilkington, to try and understand the issues better. My guest today is Mark Pilkington, author of the newly released book, Retail Therapy: Why the Industry is Broken and What Can Be Done to Fix It. Mark has enjoyed a successful and varied career in retail. After graduating from INSEAD, he joined Courtaulds, later becoming CEO of Gossard, where he was responsible for initiating the huge global success of the Wonder Bra. He then founded Splendor.com, the world's first direct-to-consumer commerce brand, with the backing of Marks & Spencer. Subsequently, he's CEO of the KOJ Group, a leading retailer with 850 stores across the Middle East and North Africa. Currently, he is director of markpilkington.net, providing strategic advice to brands and retailers. Mark, a big welcome to Building Our Future.
Very nice to see you, Bert.
So I'm hugely excited to have you here, having literally just finished reading your new book. And I have to ask first, how is life now that you're out of the executive hot seat and able to provide strategic advice from the outside, looking in on the industry?
Well, it's very interesting. I get to meet lots of people in lots of different sectors, and I get to consult and advise on lots of different issues. And I'm also doing quite a bit of sort of public speaking at conferences and media work in support of the book.
Have you felt that being able to step out, write the book has given you a slightly different perspective, or were you always aware of what you were writing kind of before you stepped out to write it?
Not at all, no. I mean, I was head down in an operational role, and it was only when I stepped back and started looking at what was happening in retailing that I realised that we were actually in the middle of quite a big change in the industry, and I just felt I had to document it.
What drove you to write Retail Therapy? Was there something you'd been thinking about long before you stepped down, or something that came to you after the event?
I'm actually an economic historian by training, so I initially thought I would write an economic history of retailing, which didn't really fill me with that much enthusiasm. You know what they say, everyone's got a book in them, but most of them don't get published. So I sat down without much enthusiasm, and as I say, I opened up my computer on the first day. I sat on my balcony. We were in Dubai. It was a nice spring weather, and I opened my computer and started looking at what was happening in retailing, and it was like, oh my God. I couldn't believe it, because it wasn't just, weak retailers who were suffering. It was some very big brands that I'd long admired. And I thought, well, if those kind of brands are going to be under pressure, then, what price everyone else? And it seemed to me that it was not just a cyclical change, because actually the economy at the time was reasonably strong, but it was more of a structural change. And then I started digging into the causes of it, and it took me back to my sort of economic history days to see what had been happening since the Industrial Revolution, which is really when retailing was created as we know it today, and how technology was changing the distribution system. And then also that there were a lot of changes happening on the consumer side, and that when you put it all together, it was really quite a big change. That was, if you like, the easier bit. The harder bit was coming up with some solutions, which is the third part of the book, which it was only really after I'd been, if you like, rolling around in it for a year or a year and a bit, that some suggestions started to come into my mind as to how to basically restructure and rethink the whole retail area in order to make it move forward in this environment.
I'd say, I think I could have guessed that you were an economic historian. As someone with a history background myself, I can appreciate a good footnote. And your book certainly got those. Retail Therapy, as you've alluded to, is broken down into three very nice and clear parts. And the first part you tackle is what you're calling the retail apocalypse. I know a previous guest on the show, Mark Robinson, would take a particular umbrage at the term. Do you think that is hyperbole, or is this really the beginning of the end for the sector?
I think that it is the beginning of the end for the sector as it was constituted historically. That doesn't mean that we're not going to have shops, and it doesn't mean that the physical experience and interaction is not going to be there. But the role of shops has to change. That's really the only way that it can go forward. There's obviously a lot of debate about whether it should be apocalypse or not, and many people have said that I come over as being too negative. I'm actually not negative, but I do think that the industry has been a bit complacent over the last 20 years, because after all, the internet threat's not new.
Right.
It's been there for 20 years. And I started a dot-com in 1999. And at that stage, we thought that we were going to overturn retail within 5 years. And the retailers thought it too, because they were busily acquiring or investing in our types of businesses. And in fact, Marks and Spencer's invested in our business because of that. And then when there was the dot-com crash, I think the retailers breathed a big sigh of relief and thought, well, that wasn't so bad, right, was it? And they thought, well, we can have websites too. And as the dot-coms went bust, they hired people out of the dot-coms to sort of help them build their own websites. And they moved towards what they call omnichannel retailing, which is, you know, having all the channels available to the consumer. But in reality, they continued to focus on their main stores business.
Right.
And they were familiar and comfortable with, you know, their measurements, you know, sales per square foot and contract leases with landlords and visiting the shops and motivating the staff. And that's what they continued to spend 90% of their time doing. They devoted really very little resources to building the internet side of their business. And if you look at the numbers in the US, it's quite striking that in, I think, 2017, Amazon had 42% of the US online market. And the top six retailers only had 11% between them. Now, these were the guys that had dominated
the
retail consumer industry in the 1990s. And to only have that tiny share of what was the fastest growing segment was a very dangerous situation for them to get into. And of course, you know, we've seen the consequences.
You can become numbed to bad news. And as actually, even as someone who follows the retail sector quite closely, the first part of your book was a bit of a, I don't know, not a wake-up call, but just an aide memoir to actually kind of really where we're at. And there's a couple of stats that you flag, which just bear reading, just to make note of where we are. So net store closures in the UK in 2017 were 2,000, which is more than ever before. But also just reading the very long list of insolvencies we've seen in the last few years, which I'm going to do. House of Fraser, Toys R Us, BHS, Mothercare, Carpet Right, Maplin, Jaeger, Austin Reed, HMV, East, Brantano, Agent Provocateur, Blue Ink, New Look, Select, and various others.
I mean, since then, of course, Debenhams.
Right.
And I think very shortly, Arcadia.
It's a big list, and that is, you know, effectively a high street from 10 years ago.
And you've also got banks and estate agents. So a lot of what constituted the high street, all the major elements of what constituted high streets up and down the country, which were, you know, quite samey, really had all the same brands, all of those brands. A lot of the elements that supported it are going.
But why should non-retail people who are listening to this care about the health of the retail sector?
Well, retailing is a very big part of the economy. I mean, it is the largest private sector employer in most countries, and it certainly is in the UK. In the UK, it employs directly 3.5 million people. And if you include all the suppliers and partners, it actually employs 7 million people. And that's a huge chunk of the workforce. So whatever happens to retailing is going to affect the overall economy. And also, the type of jobs that it offers are, you know, a godsend to more vulnerable people in society. It's often people's first job. It's disproportionately weighted towards, you know, women, young people, minorities. And it's one of the few jobs where you don't have to have that much qualification in order to be able to do it. And although the internet may be growing, internet is only employs about a quarter of the number of people for the same turnover,
right,
as retailing.
Again, when you talk about retailing, you've touched on estate agents. And that's the point. It's not just how what we consider to be retail. Restaurants, F&B, we've seen 1,000 restaurant closures in the UK. Estate agents, they're under pressure from online. Car dealerships, new car registrations fell 6%, and retail banks. And I couldn't believe this from your book, which is since 1989, the number of bank branches in the UK is reduced from just over 17,000 to just 8,000.
Correct.
This is a hell of a lot of space, whether you call it high street, retail, whatever you want to call it, which is suddenly there's no use for.
Well, that's right. I think that, you know, the old model whereby, you know, you had large, stable retail chains, physical premises, and could offer landlords long, stable contracts against which the landlords could then borrow long term in order to support the shopping centres and high streets. That model is fading away because, you know, not only is the number of shops being reduced, but also it is highly likely that in the future the size of the average shop is going to be reduced because retailers are moving away from the traditional stock model and are using retail spaces to market and sell,
right,
but not necessarily deliver stock. And retailers are not going to be able to afford and not going to want to have the length of contracts and the stock and the shop build investments that they've made in the past because the business just isn't stable enough. And people are using stores in a different way. They're using them to recruit customers to online businesses. It's gradually kind of segueing towards the online business being the backbone of the business in terms of stock delivery, in terms of the customer relationship management, the data side. And the shops themselves are being put into more of a marketing role, which is a completely different type of role. It has different needs.
This is part of a challenge of writing a book, which I'm sure you experienced, but B, trying to fit a retail conversation on a podcast. So
yes.
You touched on marketing. And again, we're seeing a full disruption of the marketing model. So the push marketing of, you know, the last 100 years with mass media channels is now being replaced by, you know, effectively a pull marketing model, or at least a marketing model where the real trick seems to be to get your customers to do your marketing on your behalf, and traditional mediums are becoming less and less relevant. So everything is being disrupted, changed, digitized. It's incredibly hard to try and pin down causation and effect without kind of running in circles.
The whole nature of the relationship between producers and consumers is changing because the system that was built at the time of the Industrial Revolution was designed to push the product of the factories to consumers. Because basically it was the economics of production, mass production, are that you have to produce very large numbers of the same thing,
right,
in order to minimize costs. And therefore, really, the whole retail and brand structure was put in place as a distribution and marketing structure in order to keep those factories running. The logic was industrial. And consumers really had very little power in the arrangement. Consumer choice was limited to a few shops near them. Consumers needed to have names they trusted, because otherwise how did you know the factory was any good? So that the brands came into existence to create that trust, and they did a lot of marketing in order to create their brand image. And basically, as consumers, we were very dependent on that information from the producers. Most of what we knew about products came from the producers themselves, from their advertising. What we believed about products came from the advertising. And so we were very much sort of passive recipients in the system. And neither brands nor historically retailers paid that much attention to individual consumer needs. It wasn't really in their interest to do so,
right,
because you couldn't support it economically through the factories. You had to find a way of corralling demand into large blocks, which used to be called segments. So you do just enough consumer research in order to identify two or three big segments with slightly different needs. You then designed, you know, very carefully calibrated advertising messages in order to sort of hook onto those needs, to push those buttons. And consumers generally responded, if you got it right, they responded in the way that you hoped. And that meant they all went out and bought pretty much the same thing. So you could you know, run the market on three products, if you like, and your factories could keep going. Now, this is all changing because all elements of that chain change. I mean, manufacturing is becoming much more flexible. Trust now is much more likely to be generated through social media, through influencers, or through peer-to-peer reviews. And people get their trust from the Amazon review or the Google review, how many stars it's got. So you don't necessarily need the huge brand infrastructure and cost in the supply chain in order to generate that trust anymore. And many, many big brands now are finding themselves being superseded by new upstart brands that have come along with a great product or a great service.
And quite often a very very small product offering. So whether it's Away and Luggage or the Dollar Shave Company, just someone doing one thing really well and getting a kind of dedicated following to promote that.
Exactly. I mean, I think that one of the things that's happened, you know, through retailing and through brand selling to retailers is you've got a lot of duplication of product. And if you go into any supermarket, you can see that. There's, you know, if you go to shampoos, you've got hundreds of different brands of shampoos. And what those companies you've referred to have tried to do, and there's a company in the sort of grocery area called Brandless that's doing the same thing, where they've managed to get the sort of 50,000 SKUs, sorry, 50,000 products that are in the average hypermarket down to, I think, 2,000 products. Because they've said, you know, if you eliminate all the duplication, this is what you've got. You've got one can of beans, you've got, you know, one toothpaste, etc., or two toothpastes. You know, you want fluoride or non-fluoride. So they've been very, very simplistic about it. And what they've tried to do is to create a great product at a much better value, because they're not taking that product from a factory, giving it to a brand that adds a markup, then giving it to a retailer that adds a huge markup, and then giving it to the consumer. They've just got a website, and it's them, and they're doing it all themselves. So they're able to offer it at a much better price. And I think that the idea that you've got a simple offer, you've got a very high specification product, basically usually the best that they can put together by reverse engineering all the things in the marketplace. And you've then got this very, very light organizational structure of just a website delivered direct to the home. And, you know, from the consumer perspective, it's really quite revolutionary in value terms. I mean, the average markup of a brand in retail, say in a department store, is 7 to 8 times the factory cost. Whereas a company like Away in Luggage or Warby Parker in eyewear or Everlane in fashion or Casper in mattresses is working on a markup of about 3. So, you know, you're talking about a value gain from something costing, say, $7 or $8 to costing $3. Now, if you roll that across the whole world and look at the whole retail market on a worldwide basis, which, of course, is enormous, I've done a very quick calculation, and that's worth about $15, $16 trillion to the consumer on a worldwide basis.
Right.
Now, I don't think consumers in the long term are going to walk away from that value proposition. I think that, you know, it's going to come through. What we're seeing is, at the moment, despite all the disruption, we're actually seeing a lot of inertia. We're seeing a lot of consumers saying, well, I don't buy that way, and I've never bought that way, and I'm not going to buy that way. You've got younger consumers coming through with a much more open attitude, but they're still a minority. But as we just play and roll the thing forward for the medium to long term, it's going to gain traction, and it's going to turn the world upside down, literally.
You have a generational mentality thing where there's still, I don't know where the cutoff point is, but I certainly wrongly attribute price with quality. So there's a little bit of everyone, which is like, if it's so cheap, there must be something wrong with it, rather than the fact, oh, look, it's nice and cheap because they've managed to totally reorder their supply chain.
Well, that's right. And I think that, you know, what you're looking at is you're looking at younger consumers who have grown up with the technology, who are highly educated, and actually are under a lot of economic pressure. Because of the asset boom, they can't afford property and they can't afford a lot of things. And average incomes have stagnated. And they've kind of went into the market after the Great Recession. So it's harder for them to get on the career ladder. And, of course, you've got the gig economy. You've got no pensions, really. And a lot of the things that, you know, my generation enjoyed, you know, growing up and going to work in the 80s and 90s, the stability of work, the high pensions, the cheap property, etc. That's just not available to them. So for them, it's not a choice. They are driven to experiment in order to support their lifestyle. And if you talk to any young people, Generation Z or young millennials, people broadly in their 20s, they will all tell you pretty much the same thing, that actually life's a struggle. They're not sure that they're going to be better off than their parents. And that they are very open to these new brands. Because they're delivering through a technology that they understand, in a way that they understand as well. The way that these new brands talk to their consumers is very different.
Yep.
So what you've got is you've got simultaneously, you've got a consumer that really needs a better solution. And you've got technology providing a supply chain, an offer that is providing that solution. And so the combination of those two is providing a lot of impetus for these changes.
And one of the things that you make very explicit in your book, which I think is misunderstood in the industry at the moment, is that you can't separate brands out from retailers or wholesalers out. And that seems to be, a wrong interpretation that brands are fine, they're unaffected, this is a retailer thing. And if we consider the traditional supply chain, basically goes goods are made in the factory, they then go to the brand or wholesaler, they then go to the retailer, and they then go to the customer. And actually, either the brands are going to have to amalgamate the retail element and become a one-stop shop, or the retailers are going to have to amalgamate the brand bit. The having the two and the additional margin in between them is, in your argument, which makes total sense, no longer going to be sustainable in an e-commerce world.
You've hit it exactly right. It's not, there are too many players in the supply chain. As somebody put it, when you're buying a branded product in retail, you're buying the supply chain, you're buying the middlemen, you're not buying the product. I remember this struck me very early on. I was in a meeting at Gossard, and we used to make underwear, funnily enough. And there was all these people from around the world and looking at this little bra in the middle of the table. And our German chief executive said, "The problem with this bra is it's just too expensive." And it suddenly struck me that the problem wasn't the bra. The bra was actually, I knew, only cost a couple of dollars to make. The problem was all the people sitting around the room. That was a much greater cost than the actual product. And that was one of the things that led me to set up Splendor.com, which was my direct-to-consumer brand, because I realized that all the stages in the supply chain, all the people involved, and particularly this thing where, you know, we as brands used to spend all this time and money creating this offer, which we then, and had a huge sales force, to sell to retailers who had a huge buying team that they then took into their stores. And then they had a huge sales force to sell it to the customers. And it struck me that that was a lot of duplication of sales forces. And a lot of time as well. I mean, in that process, it used to start, 18 months to 2 years ahead of the market. So in terms of being able to get new ideas to market, it was a very slow system because you had to first develop it, then persuade the retailers to buy it, then they'd buy it, then you had to make it, and then eventually you deliver it about, a year later. So in many, many respects, this supply chain is just inefficient. And I was actually at a conference for the electrical industry, and we had in that room a large number of major brands in consumer electronics and a large number of retailers. And I gave my presentation at the end. I said, if we were to have this meeting in 5 years' time, there's only going to be one of you here. It's either going to be you gentlemen and ladies in the branded side, or it's going to be you gentlemen and ladies in the retail side. But the consumer is not going to be able to afford to have both of you in the mix. Unfortunately, to say this to you, because I'm sure you're all great friends, is that you have to figure out how to eliminate the other guy.
Right, and I guess as we're seeing, as soon as a couple of people have rationalised the supply chain and delivered better pricing to consumers, it kind of puts the onus on everyone else to follow suit. So this brings us to part three of your book, which is how to save retail. And I don't want to dig too much into this, actually, because I feel like people should read your book to find the full insight. But it won't come as a huge surprise for people to learn that you touch on elements like retail theatre, the concept of Doug Stevens' Store is Media, technology and use optimising technology to acquire customers and keep them, becoming the conversation. Brands having an overarching philosophy and a contribution towards society, which is becoming increasingly important. So I'll leave people to read about those. But the one thing I would like to talk about is quite a strong view, which is a little quote from you, which is that retailers need to take on board that digitally enabled commerce is a superior method for stocking and distributing goods from factories to consumers. And your conclusion from this is that, therefore, stores have no role to play in the supply chain. They are purely a means of accessing the customer.
Well, I think that, you know, when you look at how retailing has developed, essentially most retailing that we experience today is what I would call self-service retailing. In reality, there's very little help. And because of the nature of retail employment, which is not a very nice job and it's very lowly paid and there's a very high staff turnover, there's often very little expertise in the staff as retailing is currently constituted. So you're essentially dealing with, most of the time, with the big chains, with a self-service environment. You've got to go into that store. You've got to locate the product, which maybe if it's a big store, it may take you some time. You've got to establish the information about this product, probably without much help. Retailers are actually notoriously bad at providing detailed information about products at point of sale. The value add, as currently constituted, of the people in retailing is very little, as it's currently constituted. So when you go on a good website like an Amazon.com, the first thing you've got is you've got a search engine to help you find the product. You haven't got to negotiate around a big store to try and find your product. The second thing you've got is very clearly and standardized product information, very detailed, all the sizing, everything very, very clear. The third thing you've got is a much, much higher chance of being in stock, because out of stocks in e-commerce are typically 1%, whereas in retailing they're 15%. And then you've got a very, very efficient, particularly if you've got the sort of one-click variant of e-commerce, which is now coming in everywhere because the Amazon patent over one click expired last year. So one click, where they've already got your credit card details, is incredibly quick.
My two points that I just ask you about is one, choice is great, and Amazon, etc., can provide phenomenal choice, but isn't part of a reason that retail has always existed is that they are curating choice for you, and that you can have a million different types of bras in the world, but you go to a brand that you trust to provide you with size and that you like and designs which you know you're probably going to favor over others.
There's nothing intrinsic to retail that is about curation. If you want choice, you've brought this up and I forgot to mention it, that the choice available that you can put on a website dwarfs what you can put in a retail store. So that is a huge factor for e-commerce. But if you want a curated offer, there's also lots of websites that will offer you that. And we've talked about that. So yes, curation is an important simplification of product offer, is an important thing that could be offered by any supplier, really, if they choose to do it. And some customers want that, and some customers want the broad offer. But when you look at the success of Amazon, and I myself have the direct experience that the conversion level on my website increased enormously when I increased the offer. Because I started out just offering my own product. And after about 6 months, I realized that my conversion levels weren't the same as my competitors. And so I started bringing other brands in as well to supplement my offer. And my conversion level went up. So people do like larger choices. And they do convert better when you have a larger choice.
Your idea of the new form of store assumes that you have the back-end logistics in place to deliver to last-mile specifications. Does the store have a role in this last-mile fulfillment?
I've never suggested that all the stock should be delivered by the internet side of the business, the internet channel. I think that what stores are going to do is they're going to probably carry best sellers and they're going to carry sufficient range in order to demonstrate the product. And if you really want to take it away with you, you can. But what most stores and most brands have is they have a long tail of products, or what we call SKUs, stock keeping units, which don't actually sell very highly, but they're part of the offer. Historically, they've been part of the offer, but they don't really move that well. And I think things like that are going to be demonstrated on digital screens. I mean, the idea that, for example, you have a clothing store like Bonobos in the States is a menswear direct-to-consumer brand. Now, they've opened what they call guide shops, but they don't have a full range of sizes. What they've got is they've got all of their key shapes. So they'll have a couple of jacket shapes, they'll have a couple of trouser shapes, they'll have a couple of shirt shapes, and they will carry that in all the sizes. So when you go in, you book a one-hour consultancy, and they try all the products on you in those guide styles to establish your sizing very precisely. But the full range is not represented in all those sizes. And when you order, they don't give you the stock. They deliver it to your home. You can walk away hands-free, which some people like. But the key thing is you're not giving away this stock, then you have to replenish it. And it, you know, there's an awful lot in a store that is about how you manage that stock. One of the reasons why store work is so backbreaking is because of all the stock that comes in. If you actually take that element out of a store, or most of it out of a store, A, you can have a much smaller store, which is much cheaper.
Yep.
B, you can have fewer staff, which is cheaper. You can pay, the staff role changes and becomes purely a customer service role. And the type of people you can get to do those kind of jobs, particularly if you pay better, it's a much more pleasant job for the right kind of people. You can basically get unemployed actors and actresses to do it, people who really interact superbly with customers and are specialists in providing advice. Now, that is something that cannot be provided by the internet. But it's not the way that retailing is set up at the moment. Retailing work is very, very low level for most people. I mean, I'm not saying you don't get great people, but if you do get them, you're lucky. Most people who work in retailing change over very, very, very frequently. So in reality, the level of human service or human value add in retailing is very low. And also the way that stores are laid out is not really maximizing the live potential of a real experiential environment.
Right.
Because 90% of what the store is just serried rows of stock on shelves.
So if we take your argument to its conclusion, so we're going to see smaller stores, these lean stores, where will they be?
One of the things that I think is a great opportunity for, you know, retail property investors is to change the model. Because what you've got through this entrepreneurial explosion of new brands is you've got a much bigger and much more exciting potential mix of brands coming to the fore. But most of them have no experience and little interest in going into retailing in its traditional form. Because when you're running a direct marketing business, like an internet business, your whole business model is different from a retailer. You start with the notion of customer recruitment costs, which typically in direct marketing businesses are very high. In the mail order business, they used to be high, and they are in the internet business. And then you deal with the idea of the lifetime value of the customer, because essentially retailing was never really a relationship marketing business. Customers came in because you advertised or you marked it down and they bought it and they walked out and you didn't know much about them. Whereas direct marketing business like the internet, these are relationship businesses. You know a lot about your consumer. You can contact them. You have their details. You have everything they've bought. You can get a good idea of their preferences. So it's all about managing the relationship. So you have to recruit them. When you've got them and they become loyal, then you have this idea of the lifetime value, because whereas the cost of recruitment is extremely high, the cost of remarketing to loyal consumers is extremely low.
Right.
So it's a different business model. With retailing, your cost of marketing is always the same. You have to run the advertising and have the stores there every single time to bring the customer in. Whereas with the internet business, the cost of recruiting is higher than a retail store, because a retail store is on the high street. People are going to walk past it.
Of course, yeah.
So people are going to come in. But with an internet business, you've got to drive them through that maze of the internet to your store, which is not easy. That's very expensive. Once you've got them signed up, it's much, much cheaper. So it's a different economic profile. So what they want to do is they want to recruit customers as cheaply as they can and then get a very good lifetime value out of them. Now, what some of them are starting to realize now is that actually, from a recruitment mechanism point of view, stores, or a type of store, can be cheaper than pure online marketing.
Right.
To actually sign a customer up.
Right? You're just trying to get to the top of the Google ads ladder.
It may be cheaper to open a pop-up store for a period of time in a high traffic location, to harvest some new customers onto your website business, where you can then manage them and manage the repeat business through your website business, than it is to run Facebook adverts or YouTube adverts or to pay for the Google listings. Hmm. And that's why we're seeing now these direct-to-consumer, digitally native brands like Warby Parker and Casper and all these guys opening stores. Okay, but I'll put a caveat on that. They're not opening stores like the old stores.
Right, it's not permanent.
It may be permanent or it may not be permanent, but it's not the size from a square footage point of view, and they're not using the stock model. They're not
The focus is Customer acquisition, not sales.
Their focus is customer acquisition to get people on it, and they're delivering through their internet channel from their distribution centre. They're not delivering from the store. The stock they put in the store is purely, the store's like a showroom, and they're just, the stock they put is just their collection. So from a stock model point of view, they're not making the investment in the stock. And from a customer service point of view, they're focusing their staff on giving people that half hour or 1 hour appointments to really understand their needs so that they can get lots of data to put on their internet business, to make their internet business extremely effective going forward. They're fitting people, if it's clothing, they're fitting people in the clothing so they know all their sizes. They can then sell everything to them going forward. Now, in that model, these internet companies, they don't know anything about retailing. They don't really want to go into retailing. Some of them are, but if they really had, in my view, their perfect environment, they would wish not to have to go into retailing in the way that old-style retailers went into retailing, with the 5 to 10 year contracts, with the 2 month store build, with the the long contract, with having to hire staff and manage staff, and with all the stock. They don't want to do all of that. So if you expect them to do that, you're going to get a very small proportion of the potential universe of new brands. And let's remember that these are the exciting new brands that are connecting with younger consumers. They're the brands that you want. You don't actually want the old chains. Even if you could refill your high street with all the old chains as they were currently constituted in some miraculous new reality, right? It still wouldn't attract consumers anymore because they're not interested in those. The thing has gone past the point where the younger consumers are interested in those brands at all. They just don't connect with those brands anymore. Those brands are not exciting. Every high street looked the same. They're not. It was already a problem even before the internet came in of all the high streets looking the same. It wasn't motivating to consumers. Now, if you want to run a really exciting high street or a really exciting mall, you've got to activate that brand universe of all these new startups with a lot of local provenance, with a lot of uniqueness, with a lot of quirkiness, with a lot of emphasis on the production of even connecting the people who produced it directly with the consumers. And having an educational message about how's this product produced, how's it made. That kind of thing. In order to do that, you've got to make the new version of retailing what I call plug and play.
Right. Yeah. Space as a service.
Space as a service. Now, fortunately, technology is coming in to help with that because these days you don't really need to do a full store fit out. Because if you put lots of digital screens on the walls, or even the whole walls of a store and on the windows, all you need is a chip, is a plug-in chip. You put it in and it converts to the brand. Because all the messaging and marketing is digital, like a version of Facebook, right? So the whole store can flip around. You don't need the 2 month store build and all the costs. It can flip within seconds. And then because they're not going to be using the store for stock, you don't need a lot of shelving and stuff like that. What you actually need is lots of screens and lots of things that produce a wow effect and some very simple fixturing that is probably standardized where you can put some sample product in order to demonstrate the brand. And you need very comfy customer areas and fitting rooms if it's clothing or whatever. But that's kind of generic. Let's say you have a certain demographic who buys your product. And you kind of, as you say, in the future, the malls or shopping centres may be able to provide that demographic information. You want to be able to survey nationally or even internationally and say, where are the hotspots for that demographic right now? I'm going to dip into that marketplace you could call it a pop-up store, but it's not going to look like a cheap pop-up store. It's actually going to look like a great store. I want to do a 3-4 month stint in that hot location, and I want to harvest all that demographic that's going to respond to my product. And once I've done that, I don't want to be there anymore because I've already got them all, right?
Yeah.
You know, if you're Warby Parker, there's only certain people who are interested in that level of high. Most people are not interested in it, right? People are interested in high-end eyewear, right? It's a certain proportion of the population. You go and put this kind of store, in a high-traffic location somewhere, in an airport or a train station or on high street, in a high-traffic street or a high-traffic mall for 4 or 5 months, you've probably hit or at least had visual hit on most of the demographic that's going to respond to you. And after that, it's redundant. And once you've got them, you're not signing them. You're not saying, we'll come back to this store and buy it. You're signing them onto your internet business. And then you're going to be marketing them on the internet business, not through the stores. So the whole role of stores changes. It becomes, if you like, marketing bursts. The good news from the mall point of view, if they can do all of that, is they can access this huge universe of exciting new brands, because the cost for entering into a retail environment is much less. They can dip in and dip out quickly, which means you can access almost all of them. Whereas at the moment, you can only access a relatively limited number of people. And those are not the most exciting people. That's the problem.
I guess that's right. I mean, that sounds to me like a world in which there are going to be distinct winners and losers, but as ever. So, Mark, I could talk about this literally all day, but we do have to wrap things up. I got my copy of Retail Therapy from Amazon, but I'm sure it's available from all decent bookstores. We always finish with our three questions, the first of which is, may you please recommend our listeners a book that has influenced your thinking in what you do?
I think for me, the biggest influence on my business career was Unleash the Giant Within by Anthony Robbins, who's, you know, the famous motivationalist, you could call him, or life coach. It changed my life, you know, when I was sort of in my early 30s and taught me how to sort of break through ruts that I got into and sort of expose myself to more exciting situations. And I use it from time to time to sort of, you know, if I feel my life's got boring, to kind of move on to the next level.
We shall add it to the Building Our Future reading list. And your favourite building?
My favourite building, it's sort of not really a building, but I really love Paris. I know that's probably a cliched thing to say, but I love buildings like Notre Dame and Sacré-Cœur and the Louvre, because I just feel that the French built architecture with such discipline over such a long period of time. I remember a French friend of mine, he took me once when I started living in Paris, and we were in the courtyard of the Louvre, and he stopped his car and we got out, and he said, look, you look up the Champs-Élysées, you know, you have the pyramid of the Louvre, which is right in the middle of the Arc de Triomphe, and then behind that, miles away, framing it from miles and miles away or kilometres away, behind is the Grand Arche de la Défense. And he said everything has been put together by a mixture of artists and mathematicians who've planned it all out. And I admire that discipline. I think that, you know, unfortunately in the UK, we've let anyone build anything next to anything. And we've ended up with, well, we've got some great buildings, but it's a real hodgepodge. But I think, you know, central Paris is a work of art as a whole.
Hard to argue with that. And a final one, which is the technology, business or idea that is your tip to impact the built environment in the coming years?
Well, I've looked a lot at the manufacturing side as part of the book, and this whole idea of 3D digital printing, I think, is very interesting. And I don't know a lot about it, but as I understand it, it's being applied to building. And I think that those kind of flexible technologies where you can, you know, can make it more bespoke to the user while still having a sort of mass manufactured price, I think are interesting in all industries. And if it can be applied to building, then why not? You know, maybe it will lead to more variety of buildings.
Mass customization at scale is coming. Mark, thank you so much for your time, for coming on the show. It's been brilliant to hear your thoughts.
Bert, it's been great talking to you.
Thank you. Mark's assessment of the market is pretty brutal, but he makes a very convincing argument. While there are areas where I may not entirely agree with him, I still think there's scope for forward thinking, discounters and fast fashion, for example, it's hard to argue with a majority of his reasoning. As direct-to-consumer businesses look to physical stores for customer acquisition, will we finally see the first shoots of space as a service emerging in the retail sector? If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, please do me a favour and simply tell a friend about it. You're always welcome to rate us on Apple Podcasts, but a simple referral is just as appreciated. Thank you for listening, and please do join me in 2 Fridays' time for another episode of Building Our Future.